Kia ora koutou, one and all. It's good to see you here on such a beautiful day. It's my pleasure to welcome you here to our monthly midday military history presentation. Our speaker today, of course, is probably no stranger to many of you, but something that I didn't realise, Glenn has now retired from Massey University. I thought it was the end of this month, but for tax purposes, it must be the end of March, was it, Glenn? Glenner is the Professor of War Studies at Massey University. He was also the Deputy Chair of our advisory group some years ago and has been a very strong supporter of our military history and heritage activities here in Palmerston North. Without any further ado, it is my great pleasure to call upon our colleague, Professor Glenn Harper, to address us today. Thank you, Glenn.
Thanks for that introduction, Joe, and it's a pleasure to be here. And it's also, I think, quite significant that you asked me to speak on New Zealand in the Battle of the Somme. This is the 1916 Battle of the Somme, because they were there again in 1918. Because with Anzac Day coming, it's important to reflect on this, that what I'm talking about is the battle in which New Zealand, more New Zealanders were killed or wounded within a space of 23 days than any other military action that we've undertaken. And you'll see probably why in the scope of my talk. And I'll come and finish up on that at the end of it. The New Zealanders were actually latecomers to the Battle of the Somme. The Battle of the Somme starts on the 1st of July 1916 with the worst ever record of casualties for the British Army, with some 60,000 casualties in a single day, almost 20,000 killed, another 40,000 wounded. But General Haig continued the battle, and the New Zealanders are involved in the third phase of the Battle of the Somme, which commences on the 15th of September 1916. The New Zealand soldiers had actually been in France for quite some time. This is them arriving and being put on railway carriages, which could take 40 men or 8 horses, and they are sent to the quiet district of Armentieres, where they learn the ropes on the Western Front. But from August onwards, they are going to be involved in the Battle of the Somme. They train for it, and they have a hard march, and their role in the Somme is this. They're going to attack between two wooded forests, although there's not much left of them, between High Wood in the north and Delville Wood in the south. They are attacking in a northwesterly direction, and ahead of them are three formidable trench lines, which you can see on this map. They're marked in red. The first is the Switch Trench. The next one are the Fleur defensive trenches, and then the final one is the series known as the Gerd trenches, just before the village of Gerdecourt. They will be involved in the Battle of Fleurs Courcelette from the 15th to the 22nd of September, and then there is another battle from the 25th to the 27th of September, known as the Battle of Morville. However, for intents and purposes, this is the New Zealanders involved in the Battle of the Somme. Now, before the New Zealanders were involved in the battle, they were already somewhat worn out, because it was a long march to the Somme region from Armentieres, which they commenced on the 20th of August 1916. They reached a town called Abbeville, where they spent 10 days training for the role in the attack. And then on the 2nd of September, they started their march to the Somme. So for 2 weeks, they are marching over these cobblestones in the most uncomfortable army boots you ever would know. They're called the hobnail boots. They have no nickname, Bill Massey boots, because the rumour was that eBay that was making money from them. And it was a little bit of a torment, because they're marching like that. And of course, everybody knows an infantryman is a thing to hang things on. You know, so they're carrying all their packs, their greatcoats, ground sheets and so on. They are carrying some 60 pounds of equipment. And it was a hard march. Let me read what one soldier said. He said, "I'm feeling a wee bit tired. However, the feeling prevailing amongst all hands now is that the war will not last much longer. I hope so. I've had enough of it and I'm more than willing to come home." it was a young soldier by the name of William Prince who's not going to survive this battle. Another 20-year-old soldier, Lieutenant William Fairbairn, wrote this. He said, "Well, we're not doing too badly here, but you can take it from me, I wouldn't be on the other side for a good bit. There's not much doubt about who is the aggressor now." But other soldiers were more realistic. This gentleman on the left is Cecil Malthus, who's a young soldier that later on becomes Professor of Languages at Canterbury University. And he wrote to his fiancée Hazel on the eve of the battle, and he wrote this to her: "If I'm knocked out, don't worry about it, dear. It's a good life here, and it will be a good death here too, you know." Not sure how Hazel would have felt about receiving a letter like that. But I've got to say that Cecil Malthus was putting on a brave front to his fiancée, because he admitted to feeling a profound moment of despair. And he admitted to this, and most other soldiers would have felt the same: "Suddenly, I found myself face to face with the fact I've been dodging for days. I was horribly, abjectly afraid of the coming push. It was not a premonition of death. Ever since facing the first thrills of imminent death on the Gallipoli Peninsula, I felt the perfect certainty that death means extinction, which actually makes it an easier prospect for me. But I could not imagine myself enduring terrible pain with much fortitude." And that evening he was unable to sleep, and he admits he was wretched and miserable, trying to face my terror. And as he said, "It was the worst moment for me of the war." Now, Lindsay Ingalls, who was an officer in the Otago Battalion and would be a Major General in the next war, thought and recorded that it was the smell of the battlefield that made the deepest impression on him. The reek of explosives and the stench of corpses. And this is what Lindsay Ingalls wrote: "The dead on both sides, swelling and sodden, mud-stained, grey and khaki uniforms were tossed in all attitudes amongst the earth and the parapets and heaved out beyond the crumbling ditches that passed for trenches. Pale, discoloured hands and limbs, stiff feet, swollen buttocks projected grotesquely from the soil." Now, the time had come for the New Zealanders to enter the inferno. And this is them marching through what had once been high wood. There was a thickly forested piece of ground, but you can see what's left of high wood now in the background. Now, the attack on the 15th of September required the New Zealand infantry to conduct a series of operations and seize several trench lines that were in front of them. There were four clearly marked objectives, each with a designated colour, and the infantry would have some overwhelming artillery support to be able to do that. And here is a map which I'll explain, and hopefully you can see the various stages that the attack was going to go through. The first stage of the attack was to advance uphill by two infantry battalions to capture the German line known as the Switch Trench, and that was the green line. And here you see the Switch Trench. They start from a trench line known as Otago Trench, so they're advancing and seizing the first trench, German trench ahead of them, which was the Switch Trench. So two battalions would do that and seize and hold that line. Then in the next stage, two more infantry battalions were to leapfrog that position down the slopes and capture two more objectives, the brown and blue lines, which were actually the Fleurs trench system. And here you can see them marked on this map, the brown and blue lines. Included were the Fleurs trench and the Fleurs support trench. Once they were taken, another infantry battalion would pivot from the blue line to the west, and here you see them pivoting, to seize Grove Alley, which was designated as the red line for the New Zealanders and the final objective. And once again, they're going to have to advance uphill and to seize that final position. So there's the first objective, Switch Trench. Second objective are the Fleur trenches. Third objective are the next set, the Fleur support trench, and then they go to pivot and hopefully take Grove Alley as well. Now, taking part in the attack on the switch trench, so the one of the first battalions off that morning was a young soldier, he's only 16, Norman Maxwell, and he's in the 2nd Auckland Battalion. And he set off in the third wave, and he recalled, he wrote this about it. This is what Norman Maxwell says of this attack. The trenches were pretty well manned and they were firing at us, but they must have had the breeze up because the bullets were going well over our heads. I had a Lewis gun, and Lewis guns were notorious for getting the mechanisms choked up with dirt. The gun was pretty well choked and those Huns put their head up. I pointed the gun at them and of course there was such a hell of a blue they didn't know whether the gun was going to go or not. They put their heads down, and when they put their heads down I managed to push the old gun on its side and pour oil into the mechanism so that it worked the next time. And when the next student put his head up, he actually shot him. Well, I managed to get a few shots off and that fixed him. Anyway, they started throwing stick bombs at us. Well, we thought these things were a bit of a joke compared with our Mills bombs. They landed in the mud, and we weren't afraid of these at all. But in the desperation, the last thing they did was they had flare pistols, and they fired about 6 guns of flares at us. I think they fired at us, and then they turned around and ran. Well, my chaps just bowled them over. The switch trench, the first objective, was taken within half an hour. Then, 2 battalions of the Rifle Brigade were allocated the next task to go beyond Switch Trench to the Fleurs Trench Network, the division's second objective. Now, James Curry, with the 2nd Battalion of the Rifle Brigade, took part in this attack, and the battalion moved off, and Curry was one of the machine gunners. Now, he's carrying a machine gun and 40 pounds of equipment. And this is what he said when daylight came. Daylight came with its usual suddenness and accompanied by a crimson sunrise that gave everything a reddish appearance. And in that particular half-light, we saw for the first time the famous new invention. And what are we talking about? We're talking about tanks, okay? They were creeping forward on our right over the roughest ground imaginable. So the first birth of the tank, first time it's used, and 2 of them, these are Mark 1 tanks, are supporting the New Zealanders around Fleur. Machine gun officer William Kirk was also surprised to see the tanks in action that morning. He was impressed with their performance and recalled the moment many years later. My first impression was astonishment at these extraordinary looking tanks there. There was a hold up in the advance, and from astonishment it became amazement in the way the tanks went. The German resistance on our advance just disappeared like that. Now, I'm quoting from James Curry again, and this is James Curry from New Plymouth on the left up here. When the attack began for James Curry at 6:20 in the morning, he heard, and I'm quoting from his diary, "the most awful din I've ever heard. He thought the sky overhead must be a roof of sound, but he looked up and was surprised to see nothing but blue sky. From his machine gun position, Curry saw a thin line of little figures running forward, each a few paces from the next, their bayonets glinting in the sunlight. Despite the heavy artillery fire, 2 more lines of infantry advanced, and what was now a sea of smoke. Curry described the sight as quite grand, and then he noted very soon the wounded began to return." Now, we've only been going for about 2 hours, and already the New Zealanders have suffered 2,000 casualties, 34% of their attacking force. And there were many New Zealanders in need of urgent medical attention on the 15th of September. In fact, of those 2,000, more than 600 had been killed. This was New Zealand's costliest day of the war to date. Now, Gunner Reginald Donald was watching the wounded being treated at a casualty clearing station and was deeply moved by what he witnessed. He recorded in his diary, "What wounds, what pain, what heroism. The inevitable lump in one's throat as these men limp or are silently carried bearing all that has come to them for a great cause." Now, Army Dr. William Aitken wrote in his diary at this day, and I'm quoting from his diary, "Busy at dressing tent all morning. Wounded started arriving with a rush at 10:30 a.m. There was a steady stream of wounded coming through all day, but the evacuation of them was well in hand. And this is probably the most famous photograph of the New Zealanders on the Somme. This is the 2nd Auckland Battalion just after they captured the switch trench, so the first objective, and they are pausing to snatch a quick meal. This photograph appeared in the Times newspaper 2 days after the event, so on the 17th of September. The New Zealand Division had captured 3 of the 4 objectives set on the 15th of September. The final one, the one where they pivot to the west, Grove Valley, was captured, but the Germans recaptured it in a counterattack. It had also taken more ground than any other BEF division that day, and it had established a new defensive line well to the east of Fleur Village. And you can see that from this map. There's Fleur, they're well to the east of it. They have not got Grove Valley. They held it for a short time, but the Germans recaptured it in the counterattack. But that objective, Grove Valley, would be attacked the following day with a fresh battalion, the 1st Wellington Battalion. And this is the attack on Grove Valley on the 16th of September, the day after the attack begins. Now, the commander of the 1st Wellington Battalion is this man here, Lieutenant Colonel Herbert Hart, who later on becomes a brigadier. He is one of the outstanding commanders of the New Zealand Division. He had established his reputation on Gallipoli, where this image is taken, and he was tasked to capture Grove Alley on the night of the 15th of September, and the attack was the next day, which he'd have to launch at 9:35. His preparations and actions, all of which he recorded in his diary, show why he is such an outstanding infantry commander. And this is what he comments on his diary. Aroused all ranks, issued picks and shovels, and set upon the most difficult night march I've ever undertaken. The night was pitch dark, the country rolling, no roads or landmarks. The ground was full of big shell holes caused by several weeks' bombardment, and the soft ground and greasy surface was caused by drizzling rain. We plodded steadily forward, marching by compass over 2.5 miles of battlefield, strewn with dead, and the whole route was steadily shelled. By a wonderful stroke of good luck, we struck the exact spot we aimed for just as daybreak. Not good luck at all, it's his skill at navigating on the front. At the last halt, and while the men halted, I directed orders to company commanders indicating positions on the map spread out on the wet, muddy ground in the light of an electric torch. The companies were all in position, ready to attack in good time. Went around them all, adjusting little matters, giving advice, trying to inspire good cheer and confidence. And the attack set off at 9:25 in the morning and was accompanied by a heavy artillery barrage, and it was really successful. Here's the Wellington Battalion lining up to the east of Fleurs. There's their objective, Grove Alley, some 800 metres away. And I'm going to quote from a soldier who was there. William Gibbard was in the leading wave, and he knew that something was up when the machine gun bullets were pinging into the ground at his feet. Another soldier, Arthur Bain, also took part in the attack, and he described what happened in the tough days that followed. 9:20 a.m. we advanced under a lovely artillery barrage and reached the German front line about 10. After a short fight, we occupied the German trench and consolidated. Things went fairly smoothly until the next day, when the Germans shelled the whole length of our trench with big stuff, blowing several up and bearing a fair number. We held the position for 4 days, in there for 4 days, and then handed over to the 2nd Wellington on September the 19th. We started back to another trench about 2 miles away. We were just one mass of mud. Our casualties for this advance was about 60%. Now, the Wellington Battalion, which had taken part of it under Lieutenant Colonel Hart, lost 150 men in this attack. Its casualties numbered 282, of which 55 had been killed in action. Its commander, Herbert Hart, was right to describe the attack, and I'm quoting from his diary, "magnificent but costly." There was another attack on the 16th of September as well, and this was going beyond Grove Valley to another series of trenches some 800 yards away. The objective was a trench system called Goose Alley. And here you can see they've just taken Grove Alley. They're using that as a base to attack further to the west. There's a series of trenches, the trench line there known as Goose Alley. And they were, the New Zealand Division committed three fresh battalions from the 1st Brigade. Two battalions, the Canterbury and the Auckland, were to leapfrog the Wellington soldiers and push on and secure Goose Alley some 800 yards away. Another would occupy the ground as a reserve. Now, this gentleman here is a very famous New Zealand soldier by Howard Kippenberger. This is him with a very worried-looking mother at the age of 19, just about to sail away. And Kippenberger was in the 1st Canterbury Battalion. And after what he called several days of rotten fatigues, he was actually looking forward to seeing some action. At 10 a.m. the battalion moved into an artillery formation and set off. Moving large bodies of soldiers during broad daylight was not a good tactic to follow. The moment they set off, the Canterbury Battalion attracted, I'm quite using Kippenberger's words, a very hell of a fire, more big stuff than I have ever seen. They moved rapidly, and Kippenberger's company did not have any casualties, but others were not so lucky. Immediately in front of Kippenberger was the 12th Company, which, according to him, and I'm quoting from his diary, got heavily smacked, great geysers raising amongst them all. He witnessed a high explosive shell land right in the middle of the 12th Company that was sheltering in a sunken road, and that shell caused 19 casualties. So after a short pause, the Canterbury soldiers reached the Fleurs trenches and proceeded in small groups through the village. And here we have some comments about this attack on Goose Alley, which, as you'll see, is not a great success. Kippenberger recorded, I'm quoting from his diary again, "Under every bit of cover were big groups of New Zealanders, and the dead lay everywhere. Travelling down the road, the remnants of the battalion reached a muddy trench, which was Grove Trench, which had a foot of slush at the bottom, and it was nearly 3 p.m. before word was passed that the projected attack was a washout meaning that it was an absolute failure. After 2 hours of hesitation, the remnants were moved back to a new trench, which they worked on improving. Having done so and settling into sleep that night, they were moved yet again to relieve the 1st Battalion. And there they stayed, I'm quoting from Kippenberger, getting no sleep with gas guards and stand to." Now, Cecil Malthus, who I quoted from before, wrote of his part in the attack, and he wrote in his diary, "We came face to face with our destiny, without even a last hopeless hope of reprieve. Destiny arrived in this attack on what he called our worst day, moving from Grove Alley to assault Goose Alley some 800 yards away. As I said before, attacking in broad daylight with everybody bunched was not a great way tactic to apply on the Western Front." And Malthus described the carnage in a letter to his fiancée. "But the enemy had been fully alerted, and the moment we appeared over the ridge, every gun was on us. We didn't even have a covering barrage to keep the enemy's machine gun and rifle fire, and we had a good 200 yards to go over heavy, broken ground. 9 and 10 platoons sprinted for it and got through tolerably well, though their losses were heavy. By 10 and 12 platoon met the full weight of a terrible bombardment, plus a sizzling stream of machine gun fire. My most horror-stricken moment was when I saw a heavy shell burst fair in the middle of Templeton. A dozen men emerged from the smoke, reeling, staggering, collapsing in every direction. More than half the platoon was lost in a moment, 7 of them killed." Now, Malthus' company lost half its men in what he described as a few disastrous minutes. The surviving members of the battalion retreated back to Grove Alley and were relieved when the attack was cancelled. They were thoroughly exhausted. Now, on the evening of the 16th of September, the day of this attack, heavy rain started falling and it turned the battlefield into a quagmire. But those soldiers who took in part of the attack remained in line for the next 4 days. And I'm quoting from what Malthus said about them, reduced to a miserable condition with deep mud everywhere, no greatcoats, no blankets, and very little sleep. It was freezing cold, and as Malthus wrote, and I'm quoting from again, we became unspeakably weary, dreary, and sick of it all. And here's a couple of slides to show you what these people were enduring. Now, Malthus was actually wounded because he was digging a trench and unfortunately hit a Mills bomb that somebody had thrown there and dislodged the pin and was badly wounded in his leg, which he described, it's a blighty, a good blighty, it'll do me. It means he gets out of it. On the 17th of September, so the day after the attack, Kippenberger and the other Canberra infantrymen wandered the battlefield, ransacking the dead in search of food and water, and that's what that soldier's doing. He's not trying to treat the soldier, he's actually looking for things that he can use. It's staggering that no thought had been given to logistically supplying this operation. The soldiers were left there for 4 days having to fend for themselves. Now, all soldiers, even those in support roles, were suffering from the dreadful conditions and were all exposed to danger. Ernest McKinley wrote in his diary, "These conditions seem endless. We are absolutely miserable." And a soldier behind the lines, Captain Frederick Varnum, who was supervising the ammunition coming forward, described himself as being wet and muddy from head to foot, just cold, hungry, and tired. Yet the battle of the Somme was far from over for these soldiers. The battle will be renewed, and this is where it changes from first course of lay to the Battle of Morville on the 25th of September. Two more large assaults were a part of this battle. The first was on the 25th of September, which had as its objective the capture of a portion of Goose Alley up to Factory Corner, and once again the 1st Brigade would be allocated this role. So what they're doing is they're attacking in a big curve motion. They want to get up to Goose Alley and they want to bend the line back to the position of Factory Corner. This is, you can see it better on this map here, what they're trying to get up to Goose Alley over here and bend the line back towards Factory Corner. Lieutenant Alexander Aiken of the 1st Otago Battalion, and here you see where they're attacking, Otago's on the left, Auckland in the centre, and Canterbury on the right, was on the left flank. He was impressed with the preparations for this attack, and this is what he wrote in his diary. All ranks had been drilled in the plan and their part in it. Lance corporals even, or senior privates in extreme emergency, could have taken charge. Such thoroughness bred confidence everywhere. There seemed every chance of success. And the attack was a stunning success, but once again, there are no cheap victories on the Western Front. Aiken recalled how the defending Germans, seeing the unbroken line coming at speed with fixed bayonets, fled, most running up Goose Alley to the safety of the Gerd trenches. The protective creeping barrage had been, according to Aitken, and I'm quoting from his diary, it's the best barrage yet seen. It took 23 minutes to cross No Man's Land and seize Goose Alley, but to Aitken it felt like 23 seconds. Now Kippenberger, Kippenberger was also involved in this attack with the 1st Canterbury Battalion, which was on the right flank. And he recalled that the German artillery response was a terrific one and that the air was filled with the clamour and obscured by haze and smoke. He was knocked over by a shell but was unhurt, and despite the hellish fire ahead, the New Zealand line remained intact and up close to its protective barrage. With his head ringing from that close explosions, Kippenberger and his company reached a long German trench, which was full of horribly mangled men, where they once again took the opportunity to dig in. And it had taken to 10 p.m. that night to complete the digging in this new trench line. Now, Arthur Alexander was with the Auckland Battalion, and he described the 25th of September, and I'm quoting from his diary, "A great day of days, we had to jump the bags, as the private soldier says." Now, the 1st Auckland Battalion was in the centre of the advancing New Zealanders, and Alexander was put in charge of the third wave. Time seemed to drag until we finally found the actual moment rushing at us. The officers shook hands and said goodbye. The first wave went over, and soon it was time for the third wave to leave the safety of their trenches. And this is what Alexander records in his diary. "What a hellish burst of fire from our guns, and what a wall of shrapnel in front of the waves. It took the Boche some time to get his artillery on, but when it did start, it seemed nothing to ours. My company captured 3 machine guns, but we took no prisoners. And we also got an ammunition dump with lots of shells in it. Working out from shell holes, we worked at digging a row of rifle pits in line and then sapping forward from this ridge. We could see Bay Palm away in the distance." Now, Bay Palm is actually an important town. It was the objective set for the first day, and when the Somme battle is finally wound up in November, it's still some 5 miles away from where they wind up. This attack had been a stunning success, but once again there were 300 casualties, and many of these had been self-inflicted by the infantry advancing too fast into their own barrage. 2 days later comes the second attack in the Battle of Moreville, and it is an absolute disaster. The New Zealanders carried out an attack on the Gerd trench system, which consisted of 2 parallel trenches, the Gerd trench and the Gerd support trench, and you can see them in this map. And once again, it's the 1st Infantry Brigade doing the attack, 1st Otago, 1st Auckland and 1st Canterbury. There's the Gerd trench and there's the Gerd support trench. This was a formidable defensive line which covers the southern approaches to the village of Gerdecourt. It was protected by barbed wire entanglements and well-sighted machine gun positions. And into this deadly killing zone would be sent the same exhausted battalions that had made the previous attack. These are the battalions in the 1st Brigade. They've been in the front line for 4 days and they are absolutely exhausted before the attack begins. Worse was the fact that artillery support would be inadequate and nothing like the overwhelming barrage that had been used on the 25th of September. And the New Zealanders had a long way to go. The objectives were over 1,000 yards away, and they were expected to cover that distance in 8 minutes. And the attack was planned for broad daylight, 2:15 p.m. that afternoon. For the New Zealanders, on the Battle of the Somme, 27th of September 1916 was the worst day ever. The 1st Canterbury Battalion was on the right flank of the advance. Once again, Kippenberger was involved, and his members of the platoon spent the whole morning, and I'm quoting from his diary, huddled in the bottom of the trench. He described them, once again from his diary, as too tired and too sleepy to talk. This is before the attack. And they appeared, according to Kippenberger, a wretched-looking lot. At 2:10 came the 5-minute warning to get ready. Then their barrage opened, and Kippenberger described it opened like a thunderclap. He was in the fourth wave, and he was relieved to get away from the start line, which was drawing heavy fire. This is what he says about the attack. "We pushed on steadily, picking our way among the shell holes and losing men every few yards. About 50 yards from the Gerd trench, Kippenberger's wave lay down and opened fire. They fired 5 rounds, got to their feet, and were moving again. As Kippenberger recalled in his diary, we picked our way through the wire, a machine gun on us from the left flank, and passed over the Gerd trench. In the depression behind and up the hill beyond, the Germans were running, giving easy marks. We fired a good many rounds at these, and very few got away, although I saw one get over the hill all right. This is a critical point. We were under no control at this time, as all the officers, the sergeant major and most of the sergeants were down, and we took our own courses. They did capture their objective, and it took 23 minutes to do that. As with the attack 2 days earlier, the 1st Auckland Battalion was in the centre. The battalion was not in good shape either, much like the Canterbury Battalion. Lieutenant Arthur Alexander described his men in the 15th North Auckland Company, and I'm quoting from his diary, "Tired with heavy digging, no one has slept since the 24th of September, and this is the 27th this day. The battalion was also desperately short of officers and NCOs. Alexander described the attack on the 27th in graphic detail, and I've got it on the board here. Again, at 0 hour, we jumped over the parapet, or what was left of it. This time we had to move half right, which made it difficult to keep direction. But after we'd gone a couple of yards, we could see the trench in front of us. We suffered considerably going over the open here, as the enemy had lots of machine guns, which kept sweeping across no man's land. On getting close to the Gerd trench, we could see it in full. It was full of the Boche, who were firing rapidly at our advancing lines. To make matters worse, our heavies, as their heavy guns, had failed to cut the wire in front of the trench, and so we were in a rather bad way. Alexander halted his men, who took shelter in the abundant shell holes around the Gerd trench. He went off and located some gaps in the wire, rushed them through so that we, and I'm quoting from his diary again, so that we got into the trench among those hated Boche, few of whom escaped and none were taken prisoner. Then they pushed into the Gerd support trench, which they found was in fact a dummy trench, so it had to be dug out from scratch, and that's what they spent the rest of the day doing. Alexander wrote, "We had to dig again. What a job. All the men tired out from want of sleep, very heavy casualties, shortage of Lewis gunners, and great scarcity of water, ammunition, bombs, very few pistols and flares." And he admitted that the next days, and I'm quoting from his diary, were my hardest days of soldiering. Now, on the left flank was the 1st Otago Battalion. And I have an account from this gentleman here, Alexander Aiken, who left a very well-known book. He believed, and I'm using his words, that the attack on the 25th, because it was so successful, I'm quoting from what he wrote, must have caused a lack of thoroughness in the plans for the new attack. Aware of the difficult task, the inadequate artillery support, and the exhaustion of the men, none of the officers in this battalion were confident of success. Now, Aitken, in the middle of the advance, which he called the artillery barrage, a rather perfunctory affair, at first things seemed to go well, but when he reached the position at Factory Corner, he knew something was wrong, and he recorded, "The leading waves could not be seen. They had just vanished." Then the German artillery started falling all around him, but he kept going, powerless to do anything but mechanically go on. Then from two directions, and he describes it here, came the herringbone weave of machine gun crossfire. The 1st Otago Battalion were trapped in a deadly killing zone, and Aitken himself soon became a casualty, hit twice, once in the ankle and once in the upper arm. In the space of 8 minutes, 30 of Aitken's platoon had been hit, and only two were unwounded. Only 12 men from the whole battalion reached the Gerd trench, which they found had been abandoned by the Germans. Now, Andrew MacDonald, who is the only historian to write a full account of New Zealanders on the Battle of the Somme, describes the 27th of September, and I'm using his words, a mediocre result that caused heavy casualties. 139 New Zealanders died as a result of this attack, 70 from the 1st Otago Battalion alone. It took the medical corps 2 days to clear the wounded from the battlefield. And when it was relieved on the 28th of September, the 1st Brigade was in a pitiful state. This is what Kippenberger wrote on being relieved. If we had known the way home, we would have inched, Turkish word for going away or vanishing, but we didn't. And Perfils had to wait, almost crying with impatience, worn out and cowering like children from every shell that shrieked past us. If we had been attacked at this time, I think we would have run right to the sea. Clearly, the New Zealanders have reached the limits of their endurance. Once again, though, it was they still had to march 4 miles back to reach the place called the Green Dump. And when they did, Kippenberger said, Personally, I was too tired to go another yard. It was only my force of will which kept me going. There was another minor attack on another trench system called the Circus Trench on the 1st of October, a minor attack which still accounted for another 300 New Zealanders wounded and another 130 killed. 2 days later, so about the 3rd of October, the survivors of the New Zealand Division, all physically and mentally exhausted, with the infantry battalion shadows of their former selves, were withdrawn. The ordeal of the Somme in 1916 was over for the New Zealand infantry. The New Zealand artillery formations remained for a few more weeks, but no one regretted leaving the Somme, as the New Zealand Division was a spent force, and it is no accident that they're not involved in another large operation like this until well into 1917. Let me wrap up with an assessment. Now, this is a picture of the New Zealand Division, the survivors of it, marching past General Haig, who's giving a formal salute, and Haig is telling them how well they fought and how well they've done. Most soldiers on parade, including one Howard Kippenberger, describe it as a punishment for surviving the Somme, because they had to go through all this again. Here's the remarkable statistics which I'm going to give you. The New Zealand Division had advanced the front line of a total of 3.2 kilometres through a series of German trenches. While there were three different trench systems they had to get through, my count is they had actually attacked eight sections of that trench line in the time that they were there. The casualties had been excessive. Artillery Commander Brigadier Napier Johnson recorded in his diary, I'm quoting from it, "Life is very short here, thousands of casualties." And Johnson wrote a week later, "During this time I lost many officers whose deaths grieved me greatly," and he listed the names of 17 officers killed in action and another further 17 who had been wounded. Of around 15,000 New Zealand soldiers who took part in the Somme, casualties numbered 7,959. That's the equivalent of 8 of the division's 12 infantry battalions. Of those, 2,111 were killed in action and some 5,848 were wounded. That is almost the same casualty rate as Gallipoli. Gallipoli lasts 9 months, the Somme is 23 days, and the casualty rates are almost similar. No wonder that Napier Johnson would write that life is very cheap here. Casualties across the division, though, were unevenly spread. And, of course, it's the PBI, the Poor Bloody Infantry, that experiences most of them. Kippenberger's 1st Canterbury Battalion on the 29th of September had suffered just over 80% losses. The Otago Battalion suffered the most. Aitken, who I quoted from, his company was reduced from 250 men, it finished with just 30, a casualty rate of over 90%. Little wonder that Aitken would write in his diary, "First Otago Battalion, quite, has been almost annihilated." Now, important lessons emerge from the Somme to be absorbed by senior commanders at all levels. For New Zealanders, it was obvious now that every time a division was committed to the offensive, heavy casualties could be expected. The crucial role of artillery was evident as well, as no attack would ever succeed on the Western Front without it. And as the New Zealanders learned to their cost, particularly on the 27th of September at the Gurd Trench System, daylight attacks against heavily defended positions with limited artillery support will result in excessive casualties. And this is what happened here on the Somme. It was also apparent too that the bayonet had limited utility on the Western Front, and the New Zealanders never used it again after the Battle of the Somme. Now, the Somme is a watershed experience for New Zealand. It's the first offensive operation on the Western Front, and it produces the heaviest casualty list of any battle in New Zealand military history. As Howard Kippenberger would write in his diary, and I'm quoting from it, "We have done our work, and we've left the home folks to count the cost." Kippenberger was absolutely right. The price paid by New Zealand families and communities was one of the heaviest ever in the war, and the effects of this lethal battle would be felt for years to come. But here's a curious thing. This is the first battle that we fight on the Western Front. It's the heaviest battle that we have fought in, but very few New Zealanders know anything about it. As Andrew MacDonald commented, and he is the only one to write a full-length study of this battle, few New Zealanders are aware of the part their relatives or country played in the Somme offensive. Of something to note as well, that during the centenary of the First World War, which wasn't so long ago, and most of us remember, when Andrew asked if his publishers, HarperCollins, were keen to publish this in 2016 to mark the Battle of the Somme, the 100 years of it, they declined, thinking it wouldn't sell very well. It came out in 2005, limited print run of 2,000 copies, which all sold. They weren't interested in reproducing this book to mark the commemoration of that battle. And let me show you another thing which shows how little known this battle is. For the centenary commemoration of the First World War, everybody wanted to get Gallipoli, particularly in 2015. So much so that the positions had to be balloted, and over 10,000 New Zealanders applied for 2,000 balloted positions, and there were hundreds of bookings, and travel agents ran several tours. When they tried to do this again in 2016, this innovative travel tried to get a tour to the Battle of the Somme, they had to cancel it because nobody was interested. What was the magic number, Steve? You could get 20 people, didn't you? 20 people, couldn't even get 20 people to go along, you know, to commemorate this battle. The New Zealand experience of the Somme, as I said, is a watershed experience, and it certainly deserves greater prominence amongst the New Zealand collective memory than it's received to date. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, I've got a first question. The first disasters from the British side of World War I, how much is that committed to the fact that the British people could buy the military commission for £5,000, you become a major in the military in one of the county regiments with no military experience and lead men and things like that?
You purchase by commission. It's a hard, very difficult question to answer. Of course, a lot of people, the jury's still out on Haig as well, whether how effective he was as a military commander. You're correct that the British Army was still very much a class-bound system, and you know that particularly in very good units, you had to purchase your commission, and very few people could afford them. Your salary went on your mess bill, so you basically didn't get paid. And you know, public school people. That does, I think, there is some credence, I think, in that argument. The problem is, and it's not just, John Laffan wrote a book some years ago called British Butchers and Bunglers of the First World War, which is quite a controversial book. I'd say now is that Britain didn't have a monopoly on butchers and bunglers. Other sides did as well, particularly the Turks and even the Germans. This was a whole new situation of industrial warfare, which this is state-of-the-art technology that they're using with outdated tactics and doctrine, you know, so it hasn't caught up. And it takes a long time for people to be able to do that. And what some people like Gary Sheffield argued that the British Army became a learning organisation, and there was something called a learning curve, which some people have said, no, it's not a learning curve, it's a blood curve, because it's cost of all these people to die. So there is some argument to that one of the problems is that we have these mediocre officers who are using outdated tactics, outdated doctrine, in a state-of-the-art world of technology, which is deadly. You know, to advance across open ground in daylight, you know, without adequate artillery support, it's only going to lead to heavy casualties. By 1918, they have learned that. The argument is, well, you know, if you look at how much they've learned, have a look at the British Army in the 100 days since 1918. Other people argue, I guess I would be there, well, they're awful slow learners. And some of the stuff that I've mentioned before about New Zealand this is their first one, and you think they would have known to actually, people on the battlefield, they need food, water, you know, ammunition. So we're as guilty as anyone. We don't bring that stuff forward, so we're learning as we go. I will go this far, some of the British senior officers were slow learners, others were much better. And in fact, the guy who's the army commander, General Rawlinson, is regarded as one of the sharpest British commanders, although Haig sacks him after the Somme because they need a scapegoat, and he's the obvious one. Comes back and commands an army in 1918, though. So yeah, I don't think I've answered your question. I'm not sure I can. There are views one way or the other. I think there is something in it, but by 1918 they've finally learned how to wage modern war. They've learned their trade. It's taken a bloody long time.
Glenn, what about the comparison with New Zealand commanders and you know, the state of their training and experience, and the fact that we didn't often go in and purchase a commission?
I think, you know, our officers tended, well, the officers at the beginning, no doubt about it, were either from middle class or upper class for the New Zealand Division. They were the only ones that were around and been through volunteers and through the territorial system and so forth. But as the war progresses, there's not enough of them, so promotion by merit becomes the way to do business. Now, in General Andrew Russell, who is the New Zealand Divisional Commander, we do have a very thorough and capable commander. I wouldn't go so far as to call him the commander of genius that Chris Pugsley does. I think he makes as many mistakes as some others, but he does learn from them and not repeat them. I mean, he makes a number of mistakes in this Battle of the Somme. You can see that. Mistakes are repeated at Passchendaele as well. And I think by 1918, Russell's worn out, but he is a competent commander. He believes in the training system, training men for the battle. For this battle, they did 10 days training, which some people would argue is not enough. They had never advanced under a creeping barrage before, and they practiced it with, believe it or not, guys holding flags out in front of them. This is where we think the barrage will land, so you practice, you know, your creeping barrage up to this flag. You know, you can't actually do that, and you know, 10 days is not enough for a battle like this. From the scenes, they spent a lot more time doing it, and you know, Chris Posey has argued that that's where they reached their operational effectiveness. That's the peak of it, their operational effectiveness, just before the Battle of the Messines. But we make as many mistakes as others. Russell's competent, clever commander, but he does make mistakes as well. He's not a commander of genius, in my eyes.
Yeah, great.
Who could be said to be responsible for the overall planning of this particular battle? And to what extent were the New Zealand commanders able to make any contribution at all?
Oh, I see your question. This one here, these plans are New Zealand divisional plans. They are told this is in the overall plan. You know, New Zealand, the New Zealand division is slotted in, and they are one of nine divisions making the attack on the 15th September. They are told this is where your objectives are, this is how much ground we want, but they are left to their own devices as to how they carry out their attack.
So it was a resulting myopic right across the whole battle.
What seems to happen, Graham, is that the first attacks are very well planned, you know, and they do, on the 15th, it is very well planned and goes well. The 16th, the attack on Grow Valley is done well, and I put that down to Herbert Hart, but then the attack on Grow Valley is not, you know, they haven't given that time and thought. When we come to Morville, the attack on the 25th is basically a textbook. I mean, but you're still going to lose people, but it's textbook. But 2 days later, that's how not to do it, you know. And as that Officer Aitken said, you know, it's almost as if, you know, the success of the 25th had gone to their head and they didn't put in any of those practices. And they're far too rushed, and you do need to plan, and you cannot make an advance on the Western Front without artillery support. Just won't be successful.
But also, I mean, it's physically impossible to maintain a force on the front line, you know, going through those various phases with bugger all food, water, sleep. I mean, they're at the absolute limit of endurance. So the mental state, regardless of anything else, would have been as much a casualty as fire.
I mean, it's like chatting by ear too. You know, we are asking people, soldiers who are tired, exhausted, suffering from dysentery, to carry out one of the most ambitious attacks. And that happens on the 27th too. You know, those soldiers doing that attack are absolutely exhausted. You know, haven't slept for 4 days.
Absolutely. Any other questions? Yeah.
What was the German casualty list like?
For this attack, it was high. It was as comparable as the New Zealanders, and one of the arguments, certainly that Gary Sheffield uses, is that the Battle of the Somme, while it produces massive casualties amongst the British and their allies, the casualties that the Germans suffer are enormous as well, and quite shocking, you know, over 400,000 casualties. And that's why they construct that, and they change their tactics. They actually withdraw from most of this ground in early 1917 behind the Hindenburg Line, so they can focus on winning the war in the east and have a defensive holding position for most of 1917 on the Western Front. So the Battle of the Somme does affect the Germans as much as it does the British as well.
All right, well, if there are no further questions, I'd like you to join with me and thank Glenn very much for his presentation and the detail of the research that went into that. So,